You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here, on my right, we've got Bobby Osinski. Bobby.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, guys.
Yay.
Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon. Scott.
Good evening. I want to be on the left, though. I mean, I'm always on the right, you know?
You like it where you are.
Okay, well.
And next to him, we've got Diego Stucco.
Hey, Mike. How's it going?
And next to Diego, we've got Brandon Birdsine.
What's up, Mike?
And next to Brandon, we've got Bobby Summerfield.
Good evening, Mike.
And over here on my left, we've got the one and only Rob Arbiter.
Hello there, Mike.
And today, joining us for show 115, we've got a very special guest, the one and only Dave Pensato. Dave, welcome.
Thanks, guys. Pleasure to be here. I was kind of caught off guard by the dress code. I didn't realize we were supposed to do this topless. I got a little better tan. Bobby's a little scary, but Diego's kind of cute.
Which Bobby?
Stereo.
There's an image for the audience that they probably don't need.
Dave, you're going to fit in just fine. hey, guys, this is show 115, the first one.
Congratulations. Wow.
It's great. Wow.
And it's been about...
I remember show 12 like it was yesterday,
I know. It was only almost 6 years ago, but that's kind of crazy.
Wow.
But
I have more hair then.
I had the same amount, just in different places.
Oh, I'll do this part of my memory.
All right, it's been a while, hasn't it?
Two weeks at least.
Today, we're going to talk about a lot of really fun stuff. And but one thing I want to say is, we haven't had a podcast in about 4 weeks, right? It's been almost a month since we've...
Wow.
I mean, even though we posted one, yesterday. Okay, maybe not yesterday. But it's been a while. So missed you guys. Hope you had a good holiday season, and hope everybody, survived. Looks like everybody did.
Pretty much.
But it's the new year when NAMM comes around. I mean, it's always Christmas, New Year's, and then NAMM.
Yep.
And they're all great holidays. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about that. And first of all, I don't know about you guys, but it was a really mixed review on NAMM this year. There's some people really liked it. Some people really hated it. Some people said that it was just boring and there wasn't anything new.
No, that's not true. That was one of the best NAMMs in three years.
And other people found it to be a very balanced show, with nothing really, taken over.
Hey, Mike, if you stayed in the section with all the audio gear, it was maybe that could be an accurate statement. I mean, for me, it wasn't.
Right.
But I went over to the guitar side, it was hopping over there. I mean, I got to see Rob Halford, the guitar players from Los Lobos. I mean, everybody was over there. It was the rock side was. Did you go over there, Bobby?
Yeah, you bet.
The rock side was really happening. Mark Laughlin with BAE was over there, and his it was just great. I met a lot of people over there, and then I came back to the other side, and it was cool, but it was. One of the impressions, I don't mean to monopolize the conversation, but it's no surprise that our industry has gone through a little bit of a valley,
right?
And I felt for the first time in a couple of years enthusiasm and confidence and hope for the future at this NAMM, which is it might not have been like 10 years ago, but it's getting better. It made me feel good. I left feeling really good. I went 2 days and. I really felt like somebody say yes, so I'll stop talking.
Yes, you are absolutely correct. There was a guarded optimism because I was hanging out at the API booth, and you get a lot of people coming by, and they wanted to touch knobs and spin things and plug things in and things like that. I mean, Bobby, what'd you think? What was your opinion of NAMM show?
As Dave said, there was a lot of enthusiasm. More than I've seen in a long time. All of the vendors were really happy. All of the people I saw on the floor were really happy. And there was actually a couple of products that were very cool that I thought were, one maybe even groundbreaking.
And that was?
And do tell.
It was the Line 6 mixer, which is it's for live sound, but it had a different graphic interface, and truly a graphic interface that us guys probably will never get because we're so used to knobs. But if you just started to started in the business, it might make perfect sense to you. And so I'm not sure. It's either one of the coolest things that's happened, or it's a complete bomb. I'm not sure what it's going to be yet.
Yeah, but I saw the demo for that, and I thought it was pretty intriguing. I must say the whole graphic interface kind of
was it iPads or was it
no. But you definitely saw a iPad influence in it as much as you saw iPads all over the place. I mean, yes. There was everybody had something that you can put an iPad in. You can put an iPad in a Mackie mixer now, and the iPad becomes the front end for it. And then they had the 48 track iPad DAW with VST plugins that you can unlock through in-app purchases. And let me tell you, as big of a fan as I am of the iPad, you know me, I am about as geek can be and techie. It's okay. It's not quite there yet, but it definitely shows that we're, you know, going that direction. And as soon as they get a little bit more powerful, the fact that RME has an audio interface that'll work, their new Fireface interface will work with an iPad is just amazing that, you know, hey, people are taking this seriously. Having said that, I'd still rather have like the Apollo with a MacBook Mini. I mean, a MacBook Air.
Apollo was the other thing I thought was
That was kind of cool.
But what's amazing to me is it's no longer. I remember back in the day, you're thinking about bringing your studio in a flight case, right? It's like the whole thing was bringing your studio in the flight case. Hey, I can bring my studio in flight cases. Nowadays, it's I can bring my studio in my carry-on. You know, you really with an Apollo, you know, and then you stick a MacBook Air in there, and then you can put a couple microphones in there. You've got your studio, so it was interesting. But I agree with you, Scott. What did you think of NAMM?
No, I thought it was great. It was. I haven't seen this many people at NAMM in a very long time. It was just a nonstop sea of people, and. No, there was some great stuff. I agree with you on the guitar side, because that's the alter ego of me, I guess. But I mean, there's just you know,
me too.
There was a lot of great buzz going on, and you know, for me, I like to always look at the smaller manufacturers, and especially on the guitar side, and see what they were coming up with.
Especially
downstairs, absolutely. They had that. It was like that percussion bass drum. Basically a giant stick and you take sticks against it.
Yeah.
And it was kind of cool, actually. Yeah. You know, just something. I kept thinking, boy, can this do like MIDI control?
Yeah.
Because of that, I could do some crazy stuff with that.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, there were so many things that I liked. I thought there were subtle improvements on a lot of gear. I also think that what it's happening is, I'm not sure from a pro audio gear standpoint as much, but it seems that all the things that we've been using for years and years and years are becoming now more accessible to lower cost users out there.
Right.
And I mean look, God, even the Apollo, the UAD stuff, but just everyone was having little really cool plugins, things that were getting really good. $50, $120, $300. There was a lot of great advancements, you know, I think at the show.
I found it interesting that at this show, you know, shows gone by, you've had amazingly massive software presentations, and you really didn't have a lot of that this year. You had your software there, but the booths weren't quite as big as they were, and some of them, it just seems like software has kind of settled in. It's like, okay, we are now, you know, we're going to be here at this level, you know. And also, if you think about it, you know, maybe NAMM might not be the best bang for their buck being software.
Bingo.
With everything that you can do on
exactly
the internet. So you kind of see smaller booths and just kind of making a presence there. But Diego, how about you? What did you think of NAMM?
Well, just to connect with what you just said, Spectrasonics wasn't there
exactly
for the reason because things have changed.
Right.
The internet, you can announce a product when it's ready, however you want it. You don't have to be at the NAMM show. But I saw a couple of things. One software was the Chromaphone, which I actually tried, and it's very interesting because it's a physical modeling instrument for percussions, and the glockenspiel and things like that.
AIS, right?
Yeah, which you can also use to create some different kind of things. I always like the double side of physical modeling, because one side is the completely accurate reproduction of acoustic instruments,
right.
But then you twist the model and you can get something else. But then I was also interested in finding some hardware, like pieces of gear that I can use in the sound design process. I found the exciter, the Aphex exciter, for example. Right. I was there with Scott, actually. We were trying it together, and it's still something that you can put into the, in the audio signal.
Was this a new one, a new version?
Yeah, they have a new version now, and basically it combines the big bottom and the exciter in the same unit. And they also made the 500 format for the API, which, by the way, API had the best gadget ever. I'm going to show you. I had to come back all the time. They had keychains made with their knobs. Everybody wanted one.
I love it.
So that's a really cool thing. But overall, I agree with you guys. The vibe, the way I perceived it, there was a lot of activity, a lot of people happy to be there, meeting, things going on. So it was a good name.
All right.
Yeah.
Bobby Sommerfeld.
Yes, sir.
You were there. What did you think?
Physically, yes. Yeah, pretty much the same. I thought there was great pockets, very exciting, interesting little pockets. About the software, I was there actually researching a sample library I'm starting this year again. And lots of times the people didn't go there because the software company is not necessary to be there. And most of the times NAMM for the software companies is not available maybe March, because they would always display something that wasn't working and people say, can I get a copy? So there were a couple of things. VE Pro. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. It's a really, really good host application. They've done a really good job there. That was fantastic. And the Isotope 5, which I've purchased, it was fantastic. The Isotope 5 Advance, there's a demo online. I've got nothing to do with the company, but they just make great stuff. You should check it out for anybody. Yeah, it's really worthwhile. Awesome. It's a Swiss Army knife. It really, really is.
That's great.
It really, really is.
Rob, for the 14 minutes that you were there.
You skipped me.
Oh, yeah. If you would know,
Best for last.
Okay. Dave was preparing.
So this was a strange NAMM for me. I had to fly out late Friday night. So I only got to be at the show for about 6 hours on Friday afternoon. And I spent most of the time in the software hall, because that's what applies to me the most. And when I didn't have 4 days to spend, I had to sort of prioritize. And, just by the nature of software, a lot of times at a NAMM show, you know, they're showing version 302 of the thing they showed version 301 of, you know, the previous year.
Right.
And so a lot of times it's incremental updates. There were a few interesting pieces of software. A lot of the iPad-related stuff was actually really cool.
Yeah.
This was also the first year in about 25 years that I didn't walk around the show with Stevie Wonder. And I heard many, many sightings from him. I know he was there Thursday, Friday, and Sunday. I got about 50 phone calls and emails. And apparently he had a good time, played a lot of piano. But actually, the whole first day for him was the same as my day, which is trying to find the latest versions of all the coolest sounds for his writing setup. Just seeing what the latest state of the art of all the DAWs is, all the virtual instruments, all the plugins. So I tried to squeeze all that into 6 hours, and it was really hard. It's not, because the truth is, you have to go to NAMM with a few different brains, because you basically first search for the stuff that you use every day and see what the latest version is. But if you're a keyboard player, you should go to the guitar hall. And if you're a guitar player, you should go to the drum hall, and you should see what's going on downstairs in what a lot of people call the weirdo hall, affectionately. But that's where all the really crazy innovation is, and some of that stuff never makes it up out of that hall, and some of it ends up upstairs years later. But NAMM is a show that you really have to spend a few days to take it all in. So next year I'll just spend 12 days there and make up.
Oh, by the way, Bobby, that was, I believe that's Ozone 5, right?
It's the software, I said Isotope, but that's the company that makes it, like saying Roland instead of saying the actual specific D.
Right.
But Ozone 5, I mean,
carry on. Dave.
Yes.
Not only am I going to ask you what you thought about NAMM, but what was your favorite piece of gear that you saw there, my friend?
I was impressed with the fact that the Chinese have finally created more different colors for mic cables than the eye can possibly see. I saw colors I never knew existed. Who buys these mauve and teal mic cables. It was pretty impressive. It was like it was awe inspiring. I mean, a black mic cable like we all are sitting with here, except for one person.
And guess
the cool mic and the cool cable.
Yeah, guess who picked up more colored microphone cables to it now.
Okay. And what was the question again?
So what was your favorite piece of gear besides the cool mic cables?
You know what? I agree. Ozone 5 was really cool. The Bricasti guys showed a new converter that's pretty impressive.
Hmm.
I don't know what it's going to cost, but I got a feeling it's not going to be cheap. It's really well done. Did you see it, Bobby?
Yeah, I did.
I thought that was pretty impressive.
What are the specs on this thing?
I'm not a specs kind of guy. Really, really good.
Stereo too, I hear. Right?
Stereo.
The guy that made it said it was great, so I trusted him. One of the things about NAMM, when my friend was talking about, you have to go see it. If you enjoy doing what all of us enjoy doing, it's a religious experience, and you see so much, and you're so inundated with just the awe of AWE of it all. I like just being there, and then I always see my old friends.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, the greatest part of
that's
that
a
experience.
Whole day. Right there, there's some people that you only see. That's at right.
Yeah, true.
You see once a year, and you know.
Yeah,
yeah. It's I've got a feeling because most of us, except for me, earn a living doing this, and so we can be a little jaded. You know, we've kind of seen it all, and it's a little hard to impress us. So, when you mention this, it's good to have someone with you that you know and relive that enthusiasm through their eyes. I always take my assistants and I can tell you they were impressed with the UAD booth, the SPL booth. You know, it's all new to them.
Right.
And I like that. I like that rejuvenating element that you get from NAMM. The equipment for me is not that much important because I'm blessed to get access to it a little before NAMM. But I left really feeling enthusiastic and really good about our profession and proud to be an engineer, you know.
Yeah.
It was just a good experience for me.
No, it's definitely a positive experience. You know, I gotta do a shout out really quick to two pieces of gear that I saw over there.
We're giving shout outs to gear now. That's awesome.
Wow. this one really was for a tech geek like me. Was my head almost exploded when I saw this?
The MIDI accordion?
No, it was the Akai Fly. The little clamshell for iPad that turned your iPad into an MPC 60. It was truly just beautiful. I just looked at it and I was just like, I must have one. It has the same gummy pads. It just had the same, you know, and I grew up, you know, touring, and I toured with the MPC 60, and I just know that machine so well. And it's, you know, it has its own groove, its own feel. And just to see that you can have this little portable thing, and it was pretty awesome.
And the hilarious part is a few rows down, Roger Lynn is standing there with Dave Smith, and they're selling an analog drum machine.
Yeah, actually,
the guy who invented the thing they're now simulating.
They had a time when I went by that booth, and you had Tom Oberheim, Dave Smith,
right,
Lynn, and there was another gentleman.
Oh, Buchla
was there too, yeah. And all four were sitting together, and I went, I got to get a camera for this.
Did you just want to hug them all?
Oh, yeah. Like, thank you. And we're going to get more Oberheim stuff. Anyway. But, yeah.
The other thing I wanted to mention was Roland is releasing this software called RMix. And they call it the audio processing software. It kind of looks like a sonogram type of editor. But it, more so than any software that I've heard yet, it allows you to put, let's say, a piece of music in there, and it'll break everything up into looks like a sonogram. And then you can draw, almost like in Photoshop, where you can draw a mask around your audio. And then once you have your mask around your audio, you can EQ it. You can add reverb. You can take it away. You can move it in the stereo field. So obviously, it comes into play with like vocals. If you do remixes and things like that, and you don't have access to split tracks or anything. Great tool. I mean, this is going to be a really great tool, and it sounds really good. It doesn't have any of the artifacty sounds that you usually get with this kind of stuff. And especially when you take out the thing that's really cool is generally if you use an audio processor that can kill the middle, you kind of – it kills everything in the middle. So even if you had some instruments that were at a different frequency but panned across the whole stereo image, you know, that goes with you also. Well, this one, it works almost like in a 3D space. So it'll leave maybe that pad that's in the background and while you're taking away the vocal. It was pretty impressive. And I don't know if they're going to have a demo for it available. But if you do any kind of remixing or even if you're into post-production or anything like that, it's a great tool for your little toolkit.
Did they announce when it's going to be available?
No, the guy that I talked to said sometime springish, you know?
Like not available, maybe
March,
May.
No, but it's pretty impressive. I do a lot of editing and I've used a lot of, you know, all the majors, and this one it was pretty cool. Especially if you do any remixing. If you do any remixing or like I mix post production, you get people all the time. Hey, you know, they're cutting a trailer and they want to remove the vocals so that the editor can use it. It's a perfect little tool.
And is it software only? There's no hardware?
Software only.
Wow. Because that is a huge change for Roland.
For Roland, yeah.
Roland had said forever they weren't going to do software only.
Hey, you know, speaking of Roland, and let's put Korg in there too, there wasn't like a giant keyboard that was out and about, you know?
Well, the Jupiter 80.
Right, but you didn't see any like Kronos or anything that, I don't know, it just seemed to me that was the one thing.
Even the Oasis, the big Korg, I mean, yeah. It's a shame they don't make behemoths like that.
Well, you know, I think one of the things I spoke to a manufacturer who's actually pretty big, which I won't name at the moment, but they got a really small booth this year. Normally they have a really big one, they had a small one, and one-tenth of their crew was there, only a really small handful of people. And we're all looking. I said, "Wow, what happened with the booth?" And he looked at me and said, "Hey, I thought the show was going to be dead." He said, "Last year it wasn't all that great, and why go through the expense?" And now that this NAMM had so many people and was so exciting, I think the manufacturers go, "Hey, this might be something that might be growing again. It might be time to innovate again rather than just doing the." Digi's latest version of a plugin version of that.
This might be a little bit off topic, but I think we should boycott NAMM until they get out of the. I started to cuss. Until they get out of Anaheim. That's the most horrible place to park, the most horrible venue. It needs to be in Long Beach or someplace close where you can park, where you can get to it in a day. Mm-hmm. It's horrible in Anaheim.
I thought
there's no parking. There's no.
It took me. I was on the side of Disneyland, which is right next to where this is. It took me an hour and a half to park, which was a half a block from where I was sitting.
I know.
An hour and a half to go half a block. It was insane.
I thought they were moving. They're moving to the LA Convention Center for 3 years while the Anaheim Convention Center was being remodeled.
Which they did years ago, too, right?
But that's coming up soon.
But see, LA Convention is terrible, though, because after the convention, there's nowhere to go. There's no Hilton. There's no hangout place. It's...
I think the reason why we're stuck in Anaheim, too, is it's the largest convention center.
Isn't the one in Long Beach pretty big?
No, it's smaller.
Not nearly as big.
Well, just doing Vegas. LAX is, I mean...
Vegas would be your only other option.
But LA Convention Center is pretty big.
I'd take Vegas.
They outgrew LA. That's why they're in Anaheim.
Wow.
That and, you know, Disneyland.
Let's push for Vegas.
I see.
And while we're pushing Vegas. For stuff, let's get AES out of San Francisco.
Absolutely. That's true. I mean,
Diego, you're sitting there.
Jennifer Studio is up there anyway.
Sorry. Just mentioning a little thing about Korg. I have a good friend in Korg Italy because I used to work with them.
Right.
And the CEO of Korg Italy now told me that this is something that might not be so obvious from the NAMM, but they sell an incredible amount of arrangers. And those are produced in Italy, but they sell them all over the world, especially Middle East. So... Korg now is making a lot of those small cheap synths, you know, like the micro, whatever the name is, but they are still selling a lot of physical keyboards, like the arrangers for making piano bar music.
Right, wow. Right.
And they're really selling a lot. So
that's
something that you don't really perceive from the NAMM, but...
Hey, Korg had Chaos Oscillator too, which I love that little thing, you know. And so,
Poly 6, remember Korg Poly 6? I love that.
So, all right, guys. Well, anybody else have anything to say with NAMM? Anybody have like the worst piece of gear that they saw?
I bought 800 picks. No, seriously, actually,
that's another color problem. I got
caught into this strange thing, and these guys that make custom picks, and they had these bags of picks. And I sat there, and I'm looking at it, and then saw someone talking about it. But what was interesting was they're all made out of different material, at all different shapes and sizes. And it was $20. And
what? I went, only?
Yeah, so I sat there and went, you know what? Yeah, okay. So I bought this bag, and I've, you know, filling these little containers with them. And there's just a zillion of these things.
Right.
But it's interesting. They're like, some are very thick, some have holes, all different shapes, some have bites to them. And I've started using different ones. I'm going, wow, this is actually really cool, because now all of a sudden I'm playing differently by different picks that I'm buying. Yeah. So it's kind of neat.
Since some idiot invented business cards that could morph into guitar picks, I haven't bought a pick in like 10 years.
Oh, the pick punch. You have a pick punch?
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, pick punch,
the,
yeah.
The cards that you push the little pick out.
Yeah.
That's make your own.
Hey,
that's pretty cool.
I will say this is the first NAMM show where I did not buy a Chinese microphone.
Nice.
Okay. I went down there and it's like, how many bad Chinese microphones does one man need?
You already answered that. That reminds me. Do you guys know David Perlman? He hangs out with Peter Montesi at A Designs and Dave Hill over
there.
He had a new microphone that he showed me that sounded incredible. It was reminded me of like a 47 or a 251 or something.
What
worked.
What brand was it?
Carlson, is it not Carlson?
What now?
What brand was it?
Well, it's Dave. Dave's a mic inventor. Right. He's a microphone guy. He's got a $1,500. I swear I wouldn't mention my other day job, so I'm not. But I featured it on this little thing I do, and it's pretty impressive too. It's like $1,500. It sounds like a 47.
Oh,
wow.
I mean, his stuff's worth looking at. It's a good guy too.
Great.
And what's the mic company name?
Dave Perlman.
Oh, Dave Perlman.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we are going to continue visiting.
Break from what? We haven't done anything.
Well, this is our
now. You understand how it works.
That's right. This is our halfway break. We're old. We have to use the restroom.
It's the same reason a dog has to take a nap in the afternoon when it has
a restroom. You guys didn't go by the Depends booth.
They go colorful.
I will say this: I've never seen more. You know, like heavy metal rockers don't quite age so well. Yeah. And I've seen more women that were like 65 years old with leather showing a lot of skin. And I just got to put the word out. At some point, maybe not so much.
Give it up. Yeah,
right. Just give it up. I'm kind of going like, wow.
Did you see Rob Halford, though? He looked pretty good.
Yeah, some of them look great and some not so much.
But I know exactly what you're talking about.
All right, well, we're going to take a break now and we'll see you on the other side.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking all things NAMM. And I think we pretty much covered it all, you know? And
did we really?
We covered about as much as we're going to cover. There's a lot of great places where you can look for interesting conversations on NAMM. And actually, one of the places that you can go to look at interesting conversations on
NAMM.
What a
segue I feel coming on.
Is Dave Pensado's internet show that he has, Pensado's Place, which is awesome, by the way. I highly recommend it. We're going to put some links up. And Dave, let's just, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got started. I know you were a musician and then you got into mixing. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I was contemplating the end of the world via the Mayan calendar in 2012. My mom was a guitar teacher and piano, and I was just raised to be a musician. I had to promise my parents I'd join a band when I finished college. That's how much they were into music.
Wow.
Quite the opposite. My mother was just a gifted lady. And I've just always enjoyed, I call it the process of making records. I'm not quite sure what that means to other people. But to me, I saw a record and I just wanted to do that. You know, I didn't even know what it was. But I was the kid that would listen to the Beatles records in stereo and mute one side and then hear George Harrison breathing in between takes and think that was the greatest thing that ever happened on earth. And now I'm in a profession that takes out all that stuff out. But just always wanted to make records. And I didn't really care if I was playing on them or I never thought I could engineer. That was just way beyond my abilities, I thought. Just kind of hand of God directed me into it. I did pretty good my first day, my first week, my first year, and just been doing it ever since and just feel blessed and happy to do it. And when you have those kind of just incredible moments and gifts, you have an obligation to share them, you know? Mm-hmm. So the show was an outgrowth of, I wanted to build a school, that wasn't practical, and so the show is just a way to hang out with my buddies like Bobby and just do what we're doing here, just talk about what we all love, and then I can't attest to the quality of it or the entertainment value. It's just literally me hanging out with people I like and know, and it's very rare. I think maybe in 50 shows I've only had one person on that wasn't a friend, and when you get those like Bobby can tell you, when you get those emails from people in some weird part of the world saying how much it meant, that's the reward in and of itself, you know?
Right.
And interestingly enough, I've worked in studios with people for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, knew nothing about how they work. They come on the show, and I learn more in 1 hour about their techniques than I did being in the studio with them, you know?
You never know somebody until you interview them, I found. I've known people for 30 years, and when I interview them for something, I go, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So it's just amazing.
I'm sure we do the same thing. You know, you go to Wikipedia, you go kind of research some of the things, and
right.
I'm always shocked and humble too, you know, and there's so much talent out there. It's, you know, why do people buy our records? I mean, there's just so many great records made by so many great people, you know, and so it gives me a chance to do like we did at NAMM, you know.
Right.
Just walk around and have fun, you know, with things in our profession. But I appreciate the compliment. I'm the wrong person because I don't really know what the show does or what it is. My partner, Herb Trowick, he keeps me in. Bobby's been on my show. I just go and just screw up. Herb takes care of everything. You know?
Listen,
we have fun, don't we, Bobby?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
You guys have a great show. Really entertaining.
Thanks.
And like I said, I recommend it for everybody to watch it.
Thank you.
One thing I wanted to ask you, let's talk about your career.
Mm-hmm.
Besides the fact, is there anybody that you haven't mixed? Because it seems like you've mixed, you know, pretty much everybody.
Oh,
but do you remember like your first session? Do you remember?
Oh gosh,
what was your first session? And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, my first session was a group called Brick. That record happened to do really well. And I'll change the subject, but I remember it vividly. I mean, I was terrified, and it doesn't get any better. I mean, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of records later, I still get scared. I still get nervous. I still wonder if I can do it. I keep waiting for that to go away, but it just doesn't. You know, it's just I learned a lot. I was blessed. I went straight from playing in a band to mixing, not mixing, but engineering in one day, literally. And luckily, I didn't. You know, a big part of our profession is just not screwing stuff up. So I excelled at that and did okay.
Where does Ed C come in?
Well, I worked at a studio called Monarch. It was owned by Paul Davis, incredible writer. I Go Crazy, 6-5 Love Affair, and Ed was Paul's engineer. And then I got a job at Paul's studio with a guy named Phil Benton. I'm not going to go into all these names, but. On the way home every night, Ed's studio was a studio called Web 4, and it was near my house. So 4 or 5 in the morning, I'd stop in, play my stuff for Ed. He'd encourage me and give me opinions and just a wonderful human being. And then I'd go home, go to bed.
Hmm. Now, in your internet show that you do, mm-hmm. and you've interviewed some really great guys. I mean, just guys like, you know, Joe Ciccarelli and Bobby and things like that.
Yeah.
Just some real solid guys. Do you find, is there any trend that you've noticed amongst all these guys that you've interviewed?
Yeah. What amazes me is the fact that no matter what age these cats that I'm talking to are, their enthusiasm for doing this has not waned even 1/1000th of 1%. In fact, guys like Ciccarelli, you mentioned, Bobby, Ozinski, their enthusiasm is greater now than it was when they were teenagers. That impresses me because it makes me feel like I'm not alone and crazy sometimes to have comrades like that. And then the other thing that impresses me is the fact that there's only one kind of creativity, and it's, creativity is creativity. If you apply it towards writing, poetry, art, guitar playing, or engineering, it's the same creativity. It just manifests itself in different mediums. And these guys could do anything. I mean, they could be great painters. They could be right. Whatever. But I'm not comparing the art of Michelangelo to the art of me doing a Beyonce mix. But what I am saying is we have a high level of craft involved with what we do. But there is a small, tiny amount of art. And I'm impressed with the creativity that these people have and the manifestation of that. It's not like they delineate it. Like you talk to Alan Meyerson or guys like that. I mean, they're geniuses. They really are creative.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by creativity.
Well, you know, it's the old saying, creative people have to create, you know. Yeah. It's like
– Yeah, definitely.
And
but the enthusiasm still, you know, I mean, yeah. Alan's done 180 major movies and he's just as passionate and excited about it. Or Swedeen, like, he's carrying his little laptop around showing me an XY miking technique. I mean, how cool is that, you know? Talking about chickens he's got in his studio. And this guy's like older than dirt. He did Thriller. I mean, you're supposed to retire technically. I think that's an AES rule somewhere. After you do Thriller, you retire. And he's just as enthusiastic about it today as he was back when he was working with Count Basie, you know?
No, that's really –
I love that.
That's cool because, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are starting their career – and are, you know, maybe the only thing they have right now is their passion. They don't have the laptop and they don't have all that stuff.
I noticed, not to cut you off, but I did anyway. I noticed that the guys that I respect so much and admire their abilities, they didn't get good because they tried. They got good because they couldn't help it. They just couldn't help working, you know, 25 hours a day while everybody else was out, you know, getting laid. They're in the studio playing with an 1176 trying to figure out how to use it differently or what's right. The difference between the black one and the silver one or whatever. And that impresses me too. But there's something about our profession that's just special. I know that's a chauvinistic thing to say, but we all came up the same way, hard work. At some point we – the harder we work, the luckier we got. That old saying, and that creates a certain camaraderie amongst us. You know, you'd think we'd all be jealous and envious, and there's that element in our profession. But by and large, what you see on the show is genuine love for this profession, and at any cost. I mean, we've all sacrificed family, health, everything for this. And we do it again, knowing the outcome. It's just so much fun, you know.
It comes across as well, the warmth. The show does. It comes across
oh,
as
thank you.
It
thank
does.
You.
It comes across as furry, and you really does.
But making records and the creative process is – we talk about all the technical stuff, all the gear, and everybody in this room, everybody that's on the show is incredibly technical. But at the end of the day, they're selling their taste. And taste is a function of your life experiences. If you're Donald Trump's son, it's hard to sing the blues authentically, and we're a product of our life's experiences, and I think that's why some of the people are so fascinating because they've had some incredible life experiences, and that creeps into your work, and I like that. I love that element of talking to people. You know, the little idiosyncrasies that made Alan Allen or Chickarelli or whatever. You know,
right. No, that's really great to hear that because, like I said, it's actually inspiring for not only myself, but I'm sure for people out there listening, you know, it's just keep that passion and keep it going because sometimes that's all you got is to move forward. And let me tell you, once again, you know, your show's great. I enjoy watching it and, you know, you're doing a great job.
Thank you so much.
And, you know, one thing I want to talk about is since we have, you know, everybody here, I want to talk a little bit about background vocals. We're going to change it up just a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about background vocals.
Recording or mixing?
Both, because I had an interesting
singing
experience. I had an interesting experience. I was listening to a mix that a friend of mine gave me, and
right
it was now. Like, "Hey, you know, check out my mix that I just did." And let me tell you, the guy sang not only his leads, but he also sang all the backgrounds. And you knew it because it was so powerful. You thought, you know, it was like he got an injection of the Osmonds, you know? I mean, it was just so loud and so in your face. And we started talking a little bit, and he go, "What'd you think?" And I go, "Hey, it's all great." I go, "Backgrounds are, you know, they're a little heavy." And but then it got me thinking. It's like, you know, we should talk about backgrounds because there's definitely a place for them and a way to use them. And there's a reason why they're called background vocals, you know, backing vocals. You know, they should add. They shouldn't take over. They shouldn't, you know, they shouldn't detract from what the main song is for what you're trying to convey. So I just wanted to open it up and just, you know, start with you, Bobby. Do you have any particular approach to BGs, like, you know,
For recording,
absolutely.
It's the Bruce Swedeen method, actually, which is if you're doubling or stacking vocals, you always add distance from the mic. So, in other words, you take what I have everybody do is I have them take a step back every time we add a layer, and you add gain. So, basically, it's the same level that's going to tape, going to the DAW, but really what it does is it gives you space and it gives you a different perspective as you go farther back. That's the way I learned how to do it, and it works really well.
That's a great idea. That's a really good one.
Using different mic patterns sometimes.
Mic patterns, right. Or different mics for
different
that
mics.
Matter, yeah.
Oh, figure of eight. I mean, Omni's lovely. Yeah. If you've got a decent environment.
When I worked with Babyface, Kenny would he'd have you sing. Sorry. He'd have you sing like four tracks, full voice, closer to the mic, kind of like breathy, way back, and so he varied the timbre of the
right.
of the note too.
A lot of times, also you get the background singers to do a whisper track if it's a soft kind of vocal, do a whisper track to add in.
Absolutely.
But you know what? The thing that's changed in the last, I don't know. Recent history, I'll say. I don't remember how many years, but especially in R&B music, a lot of times these days, the background vocals sing the chorus and the lead singer just basically agrees with them. You know? And personally, that drives me crazy.
That's been stolen. So I'm copyright there. Oh, okay. that's mine.
It's pretty much true, though, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%.
It's hilarious.
The backs are the leads in R&B.
Yeah, so to call them background vocals is actually a little bit not accurate.
Right.
Because a lot of times they're singing the chorus. And I've worked on a lot of that kind of music, too. I don't mind that if the background vocals sound like they realize they're singing the melody. But so many times in R&B, the background vocals are still like background vocals. They're way back. They're very mellow. And the lead is just so forcefully singing the word yeah or something that it sounds like a mismatch to me. And I know a lot of people who love that kind of music. It's definitely a personal taste thing. But that's something that's more of something that's happened in the last 10, 15 years, at least that I've noticed. And I think part of it is because it's much easier to record. It's much easier to turn anybody into a singer.
You can fly it in. You can fly it in.
You can fly it in, exactly. You get it once, and you just paste it through the song.
Check this out. Nine times out of ten, the lead singer will actually sing along with the chorus in the first chorus, and then ad-lib in second and third. So what I do is I copy and paste that lead vocal.
At least they're in all of them.
Yeah, so at least you have the sense that there is a lead component to that. I mean, it doesn't always help. But.
Especially if they change the lyrics.
And wow, aren't I wonderful.
Do you approach mixing background vocals the same, or is it per song?
I don't understand the question.
In other words,
I dress the same?
When you know you have background vocals, is there something that you do first no matter what? I do this in all background vocals, in other words. Or is it... Is each one unique?
Bob, you've heard my mixes. I don't have a clue what I'm doing. but to share something kind of interesting to me, I just recently started using a plugin that allows me to have access to the middle and side. And so my background's the sides. I tend to take a little bit of the top end off. I mean, the middle, I take a little bit of the top end off so that my lead vocal can have a little more top end and sit in that high end devoid space. But 10 years ago, I liked my background vocals wide. Now I pan them in. Whatever everybody's doing, I try to do the opposite. I guess that's, I don't know. I go through phases where I like the looks of certain pieces of gear. My sound hasn't changed that much over the years, so at least I might as well enjoy different colors. But and then speaking of knobs, anybody that's seen my show, I love big knobs.
What show is that? Not the same one. No.
So obviously I use 1,000 Pultecs on everything. I'm not sure about what you're asking me, Bobby. I tend to listen to the backgrounds and philosophically think that's where the money is. So I try to make those as interesting and carry the weight that they're designed to carry as much as possible. I give them special attention and sonically and every way in the mix. And I usually have a mono component that I mix back in too with all of them. But as far as equipment, I couldn't tell you what I use because it changes from day to day.
It's not even gear. It's more the approach. It's like, well, I'll always double these, or I'll always, you know, whatever. I don't
EQ. Well, I do one thing. I don't know if I can describe this on the radio, but I'll take two chorus units, software or hardware. I used to do it with SPX-90s. And I'll take one chorus unit, and I'll pan it hard left and then halfway between center and right. And then I'll take the other chorus unit and do the opposite. So it'll be pan hard right and halfway. And on one chorus unit, I'll have a little more depth but a little faster speed. On the other one, I'll have a little slower speed and the opposite depth. Mm. And that creates a little width that I can mix back in and kind of get it takes care of a lot of pitch problems. It takes care of keeping your ear interested. Like in program music, the demon you fight is there's a fine line between monotony and hypnotic. Sometimes it can go from hypnotic to monotonous by the second chorus. So I try to save higher harmonies for later in the song, and I try to lower them early in the song, that kind of stuff. And just a way to... I always felt when I was a kid, I liked the fact that I could drop the needle on a record and know exactly within five bars where I was in the song. Yeah, you know? And so I've always tried to keep my mixes growing and moving and morphing sonically to keep that interest. So those, you know, just mostly those kind of things. Is that what you're
saying?
Yeah. I think that's really good advice for younger people listening, to say exactly what you said, because you're right. The old days of vinyl, you used to stick it on the track and be 3 minutes in, you go, oh, that's the end chorus.
Because
there would be something your ear would pick up. These days, lots of times with the copy and paste abilities and mostly little less experienced producers, they end up saying, oh, here's the chorus, and they just paste it, whack, whack, whack. Yep. And there is no difference between...
No development.
There's no development.
What you hear in the intro, you hear in the band.
Yeah, exactly.
I would like to say that all these advices... To me, they are extremely valuable also when you're talking about instrumental music, because you can apply the same principle behind other things. So it applies to, you know, dance music,
right.
Even if you have no vocals. If it's very interesting what Bobby was saying about the Bruce Whedon technique, you add air,
right.
And then this thing that you keep higher harmonies for the second or third
another
chorus.
Another thing, Bobby, I just remembered, I love harmonies. I just love harmonies. I don't know what it is.
Too.
I'm a sucker for harmonies. But I like to create a chord where I can't pick out the individual notes. So I tend to re-blend all my backgrounds to where... to my hearing, I hear them as a chord and not individual notes. I just like that.
Yeah.
And so, like, a lot of times I'll have to automate EQ and stuff as the vocalist changes, but I do that a lot too.
Nice balance is important too. When you get a harmony in, you can't. You're right. Your ear goes like, "What the hell is that?"
Right.
Just pops in and out, and you go, "Oh, there it is."
You know, I like the statement you just made where you said backgrounds are where the money is, because that's, you know, that's so true. That's what really can define a really great song, even though they're not necessarily the feature. They are definitely just going to give it the legs. And how many times have you heard, you know, people tracking or when you maybe first started out and the backgrounds are just kind of like the afterthought? Okay, we need some backgrounds.
Yeah, right? Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know?
The truth is, if you think back, a lot of the times the backgrounds are telling the audience what to sing along to. So they're really important. That's usually the part people sing along to.
You've written the first chapter of my book. You know, you guys, tell me what you think of this. I know what you think of me already, sorry. But it seems like 7-8 years ago, our profession was get it on the radio, and the quality of our work will help people find it, like it, and buy it. It seems like now our profession is to make them want to own it. That you want to make them like it so much they don't even want to waste time to steal it. They just go straight to iTunes, plop down their 99 cents and own it, and they can hear it anytime they want. And in order to get to have that happen, it's a lot like the Sony Walkman days where you've got to put things in your mix for people with earbuds, people with laptops, because 85% of people hear our music like that.
Right.
And the process of backgrounds is a process of taking advantage of all the things that are contained within that to make somebody want to own that piece of music, and that's part of our job nowadays. We hate to admit that, but if we don't sell nothing, we ain't gonna get paid next week. But you can do it with credibility, and you can do it with honesty, and you can do it with integrity. And I see that as an important part of backgrounds, because my statement was a little meant to be funny, but there is some truth to that. You have to figure out the parts of the mix that give you the same feelings today that you got when you were 10 years, 12 years old listening to a record, and then just pray to God that people still feel that way. And they do. Music hasn't really changed
right.
In terms of how it affects people. And so you try to find those elements within the process that you can bring out and have people want to own that piece of music.
I have another question. May I?
Absolutely.
Would your approach to background vocals differ depending on the genre of music? So in other words, if it were a rock song as compared to a R&B song.
I mean, I'm not the only person here. Ask somebody else.
Yeah, but you're our guest. You're a featured guest.
Oh, okay.
Plus, we don't have any clue. So
we're waiting for you. Well, I just didn't have that background vocals.
I was on your side.
I just hope someone knows the answer and we're all looking at you.
Say it again, Bobby. I think I remember it.
Is your approach to background vocals?
Yes, it changes. It changes within the song, not just from song to song. But trying to think of some records that you might know, like for example, "Single Ladies," Beyonce. There was a chant, kind of stadium quality, that I was trying to get out of those background vocals. Whereas something like, I think some everybody might know, "Touch My Body," Mariah Carey. That was just to create a feeling, an emotion to support the lead. When you work with – see, I can't create. I have to pile on to somebody else's creativity. So when I work with different producers, they all have different intentions and different levels of quality of execution of those intentions, to put it politely. But, every background is different. And then, like, when you get – I just mixed a heavy metal record, and the background vocals were one track. And the only reason it was there was to just give some distinction between the verse and the chorus. And so my initial temptation was to make it wide and beautiful and all this, and it just ruined the record. And so I just tucked it up underneath the lead, compressed it a little more, kept it kind of there, and it just gave you the impression that something different happened during that 8-bar section, you know.
But was that like a double?
Technically, it was not a double.
Oh, okay.
It was intended to be different. More, it depends on how you define double, but in the sense that a double for the verse, it wasn't like that. It was more like two separate singers were singing.
Oh, okay.
That kind of feeling.
Yeah.
In fact, it got too tight in a couple of spots, so I actually slid it out of time and just to make it to where it did give you the feeling. I put a little more, you know, like I put a little reverb on it, just kind of set it behind the lead singer. And every song is different in every way. I tell you what, everybody at this table can agree. I mean, the minute you think you got a mic, did somebody fart? Did you hear that, Diego?
No, I didn't.
No, you heard someone.
You know what they say. The schoolyard saying was...
in Italy, we say the first chicken that sing, the one that laid the egg.
Well, the interesting thing is it was in F sharp. So kind of caught my hair. I completely lost my... I'm sorry, guys. That's the last time I'll be invited here. Sorry, Bobby. But for my British colleague, they're into like that sort of humor.
Thank you.
That is funny.
You know, it's interesting. We, you know, you talk about Single Ladies. The vocals on that. I mean, that just pretty much proves your point about singing along with and everything, mm-hmm. and about the backgrounds being the money. I mean, that's a fantastic song. Great mm-hmm. example.
Those guys. Red Zone and those guys, yeah, the guys Tricky who produce Stewart. That stuff, Tricky Stewart yeah. and Coo Carell, and Coo, those guys yeah. are really, really, really talented.
Extremely.
Well, anyhow, I hope you guys out there gleaned some information on background vocals, because believe it or not, I mean, I've learned a lot. I learned a ton, and wow, that's awesome. And Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
I have a question about background vocals.
Okay.
If you're working with a group like Take Six, do you print an a cappella?
Ha! That was deep.
Think about that.
No. Okay.
Hey, if you're working with a group like Take Six, you convince them to just do it.
I had another problem with That's background right. vocals. I was mixing a Michael Jackson record called Hollywood Tonight, which hit a couple of months ago. And I printed a TV track. I wonder why I did that.
Hologram. Hologram. You never know.
I'm going to fry him. Just get out of here.
You sell it to Cirque du Soleil. Or
all right. Well, hey, Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
I had a blast. I apologize to all my friends here for monopolizing the conversation.
Oh, no.
That was the whole point.
It was great. Yeah.
We heard more.
Just listen to
I it. Swear if I come back, I'm going to listen.
No, just listen to 114 and you'll know why this is a great show.
I had a blast. Thanks, guys.
Before we go, rather than going around and asking anybody what you're working on, because most people can't talk about what they're working on right now, I just want to open it up. Anybody do anything that they want to talk about that has hit recently?
I just did a 2-week speaking tour with Ken Scott.
Oh, nice.
Ken and I went out in the Midwest, and we finished in Nashville at a couple of colleges, and it was really good.
Great.
What was your favorite moment from that, from Ken's part, not your part? Because he's got stories for days.
And I know most of them from co-writing the book with him.
What was the one that you're like, oh, my God? That
I'll tell you the best thing. He gives a presentation where what he'll do is he'll play individual tracks from All Things Must Pass. Like he'll take one of the big hits, My Sweet Lord, right? And he'll break it down, so you'll hear just the bass and you hear the drums, and it's only 8 tracks wide, you know, but you hear these tracks and you go, oh, because they sound pretty bad. And all of a sudden you put them together. Actually, one of them sounds really good. It's Eric Clapton playing rhythm. But all of a sudden he puts them together and you go, that's the hit. That's great. That's what I remember. But if you listen to him individually, and he does the same thing with Bowie, with the Bowie song and with the Elton song.
That's cool.
So, and that's what's so great about it, you know, just to hear these tracks. I always love that. I love to hear the hits and when they're deconstructed, to hear what's going on, you know, because a lot of times it fools you where...
It gives us hope.
Yeah.
I tell you something, that's a very good point. I won't go off on this, but I've often done that. I've listened to somebody's hit and listened to the individual tracks and go, well, that ain't very good. Yeah. If I was doing that, I must really fix that. But I put it together and I go, man, that's why they're doing this record and I'm not. Yeah. I mean, that's basically it, you know. Smarts to be able to stand back.
That's cool. I wish I could... Go hear you guys talk.
Well, have Ken on.
Well, hey, don't believe me. I'll be talking to you after the show. Anybody else have anything they want to?
Well, I just posted something online yesterday. It's a small piece of music I made with a ceramic plate.
Wow.
Well, I was getting a slice of chocolate cake, but then the plate made a sound, and I had to pause the thing for a second, grab the computer, setting up a microphone, and it sounds really bizarre.
Was this an average white band song?
Dinner takes a long time.
Right? Another
cake.
All right.
Yeah. But anyway, it's online. It's called Improv from a Plate. On a Plate.
And probably, all right, and you can also you probably can link to it from your website too.
Yes,
right?
Yes,
and your Vimeo channel,
yep,
correct?
Yep.
And I'll just mention one thing. There's a lot going on, but for whatever reason, Scott and I have been friends for over 2 decades. I don't even know how long.
Long time.
But for whatever reason, all of a sudden, we're working on a ton of stuff together, and it's been fun.
Yeah, tons.
It's
of
been fun.
Fun.
Little exhausting sometimes.
Hey,
but it's fun.
Having said that, I got to give a shout out to Scott because we finished working on a project together.
By the way, I'm a whore.
No, it was, and it just started airing on. All the commercials came out on TV this past week, and you can also see it in GameStop in their TV. And it's for the just finished mixing the Darkness 2 trailer. So the TV trailers and stuff, and the sound design was done by Soundalux, and Scott. Scott supervised that, and it was, let me just tell you, it was a pure pleasure, all right? It was going to a pro place where you had guys, we did the playback, and if it wasn't for the client, it would have been awesome. Just kidding. Just kidding.
Wow, that was out loud, Mike. You actually said that with your out loud voice.
It's fun to work with pros, isn't
it?
No,
it was a blessing.
What a concept.
And being, you know, I do mixing post-production. I work with all kinds of sound designers on all kinds of different projects. And you know, I've worked with a guy in the garage, and I work with and there's nothing wrong with that. You can get some really good guys, some really good sounds pairing the budget. But when you have the budget to just do it right, it's just a luxury.
You know, I just also got finished doing something which in the film side is pretty rare. A friend of mine did a film called Any Day Now, and we're just about finishing the mix probably the next 2 days. And we spent the last month, instead of having a whole backfield and the politics and everybody weighing in, it was just been the director and myself. That's it.
Wow.
And we've just been sitting together, going through the sounds, going through the dialogue, mixing, very intimate, having lunches, just simple. And I mixed probably 90% of it in my room in the box. But then what's fascinating is I took it out of my studio, went over to the Taddeo stages, been learning the System 5, hearing the differences, you know, especially obviously with the big room. And I'm used to theaters, but having a System 5, and it's the new software.
Yeah.
So now I could control Pro Tools from a Euphonics and at the same time use the audio paths within Euphonics. And it's fascinating trying to decide which, in any given movement, what do I want to do?
Right.
Do I want to do it inside the box or do I want to do it on the mixer? You know, what EQs do I want to use? And it's been such a joy and fascinating, and he's allowed us to experiment, and or me, I guess, it's just me, myself, and I, all three of us. And it's been a ton of fun, and we've played the movie back now a bazillion times, and we're making our final let's hear the movie again and pass, and yeah, you know. Now that I've heard it for the 100th time, and I've heard that one little thing, then let's go after that.
Right.
That's been fun.
That's great. That's you know what? I got to go back to The Darkness really quick. If you really want to hear where you can get some quality sounds from a place like Soundalux, if you listen to the trailer, it's on YouTube, and you'll see it in GameStop. The Foley that we got from Soundalux was just awesome, because there's a couple shots where these guys, they jump out of this van and they have boots on and they're all in like gear, like SWAT team gear, and you hear all the clanking and all the rubbing and all that, and it's just stuff like that. In the last shot where, you know, this troop of looks like SWAT guys are rushing, it was just gorgeous. It was so full, and that's the kind of stuff where working with a place like Soundalux, where they have the skill and they know it's not just, you know, just the footsteps. It's also the footsteps, but the clothes. But they're not just the clothes, because they all have gear belts on, and it's the swinging of the – it's the sound of the clothes and the sound of the belts and things like that and things. It was amazing.
I'll say one thing on that front for people that are into post-production. everything I learned from music, and I'm still learning from music, because Foley to me is percussion, and weapons are kick drums and tom-toms and guitars and getting depth of field. That's why I love when you talk about different depths in recording, in that, you know, I think we try to create 3D audio in space and trying to, if everything, like a lot of young sound designers want every single instrument, every sound to be perfect and bright and punchy and all that, and you put it together and it doesn't work. Sometimes you need to smudge it a little bit. It's like a painting. I always look at the visuals. Something needs to be really, really sharp. And then you take the background and you defocus it a little bit. And that's within any given second. And you're constantly changing that. And everything, you know, it's the same techniques that I hear you guys talking about in music that we apply in post-production,
right,
and try to make it punchy and help tell a story.
I think that... I know very little about post, and I'm fascinated by it, especially Foley, because I think our profession, or my profession, is heading that way. Because I think, have you guys seen that National Geographic special, Brain Games? Yeah. The brain doesn't like to improvise. It likes to have a library back there to compare sounds to, and so Foley is the ultimate tricking of the brain to make it think that those sounds are actually coordinated with what visuals you see. And I think that's an underutilized area in mixing, is we're so literal that sometimes we forget that you can create all sorts of images in the mind with such simplicity,
right,
that the Foley guys do. And I've been exploring that a lot lately in my mixes, that mostly they all get erased, but I really think there's something there that you guys have an advantage with and a great head start that we've underutilized in just regular mixes. That like some of the great records that we grew up on as kids, you know what color the guitar George Harrison was playing, you know, yeah. You just have that image. I mean, whether it's right or wrong is irrelevant. It's just that you have that strong image, and I've been trying to work with that in my mixes, and I haven't been so successful at it, but I think it's a worthy effort, and I think stealing from the Foley guys is the shortcut to success for that. Possibly, I don't know.
You know what? Actually, I mean, go back and listen to Michael Jackson's record. Yeah. He was basically doing Foley,
yeah,
while he was singing. He was kicking the floor, hitting the walls.
Mixed Hollywood Tonight. It's like it's, you're right.
And Bruce
he even used to do separate tracks where he'd do a vocal. I mean, he would make a lot of noises while he was singing, and he'd hit his chest and everything. But he'd also then have you run a track after of just like hitting the walls or hitting his chest.
Timing was immaculate.
We did Black and White. Mm-hmm. You know, I did all these Michael Jackson videos early on, and he had the thing where there was the long play version where he broke things and he smashed cars and he turned the leopard and all that. And we were like, okay, we're going to do Foley. And then we said, do you want to do the Foley? And he's like, sure.
And did anybody film that? That would be incredible. Yeah, no. So.
And then he basically got on the stage and he figured it out pretty quickly and started just doing the movements. Because, you know, there's certain times on a Foley stage where you need the right people to do the right things. And it sounds silly. I did a poker movie years ago with pro players, and you get a guy just turning a card, it's not the same. There's a certain flick. There's a certain chip sound. There's this authenticity to something. So when Michael did it, to have somebody do Michael's footsteps.
Oh, it was never, no.
It's like, no, why? So it's just get him to do it, because he's got that. It's not flat-footed.
Right.
He's doing these nuances with his feet that you got to record, because he knows how to do that.
And you know, you can really hear it on his records. You don't even have to listen that closely. Yeah, you just have to listen with that in mind.
Well, hey guys, we're going to have to wrap it up now. But
no,
like
I
said,
don't think so. This is going really well.
Okay, part three.
Let's take a look. Yeah.
But once again, Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I want to, everybody out there, Google his Pensado's Place, and do you know what the URL is for that?
Excuse me?
Do you know what the URL is for your...
You can find it at pensadosplace.tv, no apostrophe, just pensadosplace.tv, and we've got a list of all the episodes.
Great. So you should get about, let's see, our listenership. Yeah, you'll get about 8 more people.
Yeah.
That's including my 8 people win. I wonder why I had nobody watching the show last week.
They're coming back.
No, but Dave, thank you so much.
Oh,
you're,
my pleasure.
You're welcome
a
back anytime. And Bobby O, thank you for setting it up.
My pleasure.
That was pretty cool.
Bobby's my guy.
All right. Well, if you have any comments or questions, or you want to ask a question to any one of the guys here, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you can also catch us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/audionowcast. So from myself and all the guys, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.